This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Listening today to Ted Robinson of Sacramento, California. Remember his time as a PT boat skipper in the Pacific during World War II. Very dangerous duty that almost claimed his life and very nearly claimed the life of John F. Kennedy 20 years before that assassin's bullet in Dallas. On August 1st, 1943, Ted was at the controls of one boat. Just a stone's throw away was Kennedy and PT-109. You were getting to the relevance of the mufflers on your PT boats and how you had to be careful with them in these night attacks against the Japanese.
We would sneak in with our mufflers closed until they discovered us. Now, luckily, the Japanese did not have radar, nor, incidentally, did Jack Kennedy, nor any of the other nine boats or so. But we sneaked in. But the Japanese would have a little guy way up 100 feet high in the crow's nest, and they saw all of us before we saw them, except for Ross radar boats. And we went in very carefully until they spotted us. Now, when they spotted us, it's unbelievable. They turn on all these searchlights, and there's nothing makes you feel more bare than those searchlights. It reminded me when I was at Duke in my little 34 convertible with my little southern girlfriend from Norton, Virginia, and the campus cop would put the flashlight in the window and when we were parked in Lover's Lane. Boy, those searchlights are come on. Now, all those searchlights are now, of course, in front of car dealers selling Hondas and Toyotas that we're all driving, which don't get me started on that. But anyway, when those searchlights came on, it was really beautiful. Because they had these beautiful searchlights, and suddenly there were all these fountains all around you. What they were shells, five-inch shells. We would have four destroyers with five-inch major guns. In other words, 20 five-inch guns, all their anti-aircraft guns, and 900 soldiers lying shoulder to shoulder, all firing at us. And that the explosions would push our boat sideways and throw water over us, but they kept missing. Now, they didn't always keep missing. We lost scads of boats, but we didn't lose the 159 that night. And so the minute you're discovered, you open your mufflers, which takes about 10 minutes, and that's key to this whole Jack Kennedy thing, and then you're committed. So you push your throttles forward and you go in. Of course, the planes are immediately on top of you, but you're committed now. And we went in to 1,400 yards. Now, you're a football announcer. 1,400 yards sounds like a long ways. That's 14 football fields. But broadside to all that firepower, it was horrifying. And we closed to 1,400 yards, and we fired our torpedoes. Now, the only reason any PT boat guy is alive today that made a destroyer attack is after we fired our torpedoes, we would make a very tight turn to make our escape, to hopefully make our turn where you really slow down and you're really going to die. They had to take a defensive maneuver. And that maneuver was to turn into us to expose only their narrow bow instead of their whole broadside to our torpedoes.
Right.
When they made that turn going at top speed, they went 39 knots, almost 40, 50 miles an hour. The decks would lean over and you would see their gunfire on one side going in the water and the other side going up in the air. And that's what saved us. Because they turned into us so they would only expose that narrow bow. And secondly, to ram us. Jack wasn't the only PT boat rammed. He was the only PT boat that had a president in it that was rammed. Nobody gives a damn about a park commissioner like me, which I am. I'm the park commissioner in Sacramento County Parks. But anyway, we made our turn, and we got out. And once you make your turn, we had a smoke screen generator on the stern that put up white smoke. White smoke, if you remember 4th of July, is very effective against floodlights.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go at high speed because we would have lost 6 tons in weight. Those torpedoes weighed a ton and a half each, and we would zigzag behind the smoke screen at high speed trying to get out alive. Well, we got out alive, and so did the 157 next to us. And we went back across Blackett Strait out of range from the destroyers, and we pulled up next to the 157 boat. And because Brantingham was in charge of the entire attack, was on my boat, he shouted off to Liebenauer's boat. He said, did you fire all four fish, all four torpedoes? And they said, no, we only fired two. Brantingham said, get your butt in there and fire the other two. I think I would have jumped over the side before I did that. But Liebenauer did. He went in there
and
tried to find him. Now, that's what happened to us. Now, what happened next? Why, we were talking to the 157. We saw this terrible explosion just south of us, about where Jack Kennedy and PT-109 and the 162 boat. There were two of them back in there. We knew that from the radar, and we knew that's where they had gone. They were desperately trying to get into position to attack the destroyers, when suddenly, coming from the south, the destroyers had unloaded their troops at Munda, and they were coming back from an unexpected direction in total darkness at top speed, trying to get back out of there alive. And Jack Kennedy was going at very slow speed. You couldn't go over 6 knots with your mufflers closed, so you just had a drift, kind of. And his mufflers were closed by order of all of us. Otherwise, the Japanese planes, the Japanese shore battery could hear us. We had three 1,500-horsepower engines. You could hear those. That's 6,000 horsepower. You could hear it for 25 miles if your mufflers weren't closed. Suddenly, the starboard lookout, who was in the starboard gun turret, screamed a warning, and he saw two ships coming right at him. Now, the next thing that Mommy Dearest books, who criticized Jack, saying he was asleep, is what they say. Imagine being asleep during that gunfire. Holy crap. Anyway, all those cannons going off and searchlights. Well, anyway, when you're back in the States, you can write a book with a bunch of lies. But by anything, that's what these guys do that hate Kennedy. But anyway, so Jack was cruising back for it. Now, the next thing he had to do, he had to make sure those two ships coming right at him were not American PT boats.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he'd be firing into his own men. And we did that a lot. And we wanted to avoid that. We got orders every night. Make sure they're the enemy. Or were they maybe American destroyers at Humpton? So we had to pause and watch for that. And once he saw it was really Japanese ships, he looked up in horror. They were coming right for him. And he jammed his throttles forward. He did just what you would have done, all your audience in Fresno would have done, all the Mommy Dearest books writers would have done. It was his only chance. He knew it took 10 to 15 minutes to open his mufflers.
Yeah, no choice.
Because he had to push a button up on the control cabinet, up in the cockpit. And anyway, what happened? The bow floated. Now, all the men were thrown into the water and into the flaming gasoline. But fortunately, Jack told me the only reason they survived is that destroyer was going so fast, the bow wake of the destroyer carried the flaming gasoline away from the wooden hull of the PT boat. That meant he could jump over the side, which he did, and drag back his men. Doing so, he got terribly burned by gasoline burns. We had 3,000 gallons of gasoline on those boats. And he dragged them back to the bow. And then the next day, they were all cleaning the bow. Of course, the machinist mate in the engine room had drowned, and some others had died. But 11 were still alive, and they were hanging onto the hull. And the hull started to drift towards Kuala Mangara, where the Japanese had 40,000 enemy troops. So that night, Jack took the most severely wounded man and towed him with his teeth all the way to a little island called Palm Island. And the rest made rafts out of wreckage and finally got over to Plum Island. And for a whole week, Jack Kennedy went out day after day trying to flag us down, coming through that Ferguson Passage because the island he purposely swam to, Plum Island, was right next to Ferguson Passage, and there were no Japanese on that island. So he, night after night, swam out there trying to attract us. Well, we were looking up. We were looking up at the float planes that were bombing us. We didn't see a little man down in the waves. Well, we finally found out. We got two Melanesian natives paddled 30 miles and handed me a coconut. That's the most famous coconut in the world. And on a jacket scratched, 11 still alive, send help, JFK. They handed it to me. I handed it to Branningham, my commanding officer. And Branningham said, Robbie, would you like to go in on the rescue mission? And thank God I said yes. I said yes because I like Jack. You don't turn down your commanding officer, and I wanted to really help him. So we went 30 miles behind enemy lines. We finally found him back there in Plum Island. We brought him and what was left of his crew home. Then they sent him back down the line to recuperate. And a month to the day later, I lost my boat 70 miles behind enemy lines. They put me in the same tent with Jack. I got to be great friends with him. We lived alone for 2.5 months together. I got to know what he was like, what he talked about, and so on, and became his friend for the rest of his life. And I married a lovely girl whose family did a lot of the fine artworks in Jackie's home, Jackie Kennedy's home. So we both had wives that were from Newport whose families knew each other. I kept in touch through my father-in-law, who would frequently be at Jackie's home when Jack was there, and we would send messages back and forth through my father-in-law.
When you spent that time with him in that tent, and obviously you knew what kind of family he was from and the influence his father had had, but did you have any inkling that this guy next to you without a shirt on is still recovering from all these wounds and using a cane, which you have since donated to the Smithsonian? Did you have any inkling that this was a future president of the United States?
I knew he was smarter than I was. He was very smart. And the thing that really convinced me is we had never had a candy bar for half a year, and the destroyers had candy. I took my candy and I threw the wrapper in the jungles after I... Jack didn't do that. We had nothing to read. We were reduced to nothing. We were, you know, we didn't get any mail or anything. And so he would read all the ingredients of the candy wrapper because that's what he was reduced to. And he'd say, Robbie, how come the Hershey bars have 20% corn syrup and Baby Ruth? I knew then this guy was sharp. The smart people in the world are curious about everything. The other thing that I was privileged to be with him, he said, you know, he always made friends with the chief of the village. We lived in native villages the whole time around there. And he said, you know, I've been talking to the chief, and these people have a life expectancy of 35 because they have no medical help whatsoever. And he said to me, alone in the tent, someday a wealthy country like America should help people like this. I didn't realize it at that time, but that was the start of the Peace Corps, and I was privileged to be alone in the tent when he came up with that thought. I was just thinking, oh, they're just natives, so what? Not Jack. He wanted to know how he could help them. He was a great guy. He had a great sense of humor. When we picked him up, he was burned, he was disabled, he couldn't walk, his feet were in shreds, and you know what he said? In the darkness, he said, where in the hell have you guys been? I've been at this bus stop for a whole week now. Can you imagine that? The sense of humor he had when he had been starving for a week. He was burned. He was crippled. His feet were gone. He was a great guy.
That's probably
and
a lot
I
of what kept him going.
Originally was a Republican. Now, that comes from a Republican. Sorry about that, you Republicans. He was a great guy.
Well, Ted, I think the same can be said of you. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time, and I hope people will get your book so they can read the rest of your incredible story. That book is Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. You can find it on Amazon, on Merriam Press. Ted, in closing, is there any one thing that your experience in the Navy in World War II taught you that you think has been really important in the rest of your life?
Yeah, and that is you got to persevere no matter how bad things get. You got to stick to them, and I love my country. I love it to this day. And don't ever let any of your listeners reduce our military. So we're in the situation we were in the start of World War II because our torpedoes were no damn good. We were using World War I torpedoes, 30 years old, giving our lives to go in to try to sink the enemy. Don't ever let us get in that situation again. Kids, look out for your country.
Well, I hear you. Ted, thank you so much for serving our country, for sharing a little bit of your story today, and I hope everybody listening will read the rest of it in your book. Thanks a lot, Ted.
My regard to everybody in Fresno. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And, of course, to everywhere Hometown Heroes is heard. If you heard Ted telling that story here, you can imagine the kind of storytelling in his book, Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. Check it out on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and maybe the next time you ponder President John F. Kennedy. You'll remember him as one of the more than 16 million Americans who risked their lives for the sake of our freedom during World War II. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.